Welcome one and all to the world's only podcast, the only podcast in the world, brought to you each month from the AOS 21 Podcast Network, hosted on Podomatic. And now for our commentators.
So, Corey, you're a basketball guy, right?
I am.
All right. Tell me this. Is Space Jam, the original Space Jam, is that a good movie?
Well, it's good if you were 12.
Okay, but you and I are in our 30s.
Yep.
Is it good?
No. I mean, come on. It's meant for kids. I mean, you know, any criticism of the new one has to be seen in that light. Don't watch it as an adult unless you are there with your child.
Yeah, you can't ruin something that wasn't great to begin with. That's our word of advice. Welcome to a brand new World's Only Podcast, a monthly news refresher podcast. It is August 2021. I'm your co-host, Ian Roberts. With me today,
Corey Parker of AS21 as well, former editor-in-chief when we were actually doing books.
Corey Parker! Sylvie couldn't make it this month, so we put up the Corey signal, and Corey, you graciously agreed to step in. Thank you so much. It's been a while since we've talked. How have you been?
Pretty good. Yeah, I was on the June 2020 podcast, so it's been a while, yes.
Okay, so, but you have been here during the pandemic.
I have, yeah. It was towards the beginning. I don't remember how much we even talked about it, but I feel like things have gotten better since then, so that's good.
Well, we'll get to that in the meat of the episode, because are things getting better? I don't know yet. Yeah, I'd forgotten that you'd stepped in, because that was during a part of the pandemic when I was taking care of a kid, and both of us were working from home all the time, and it was... So in that sense, yes, things have gotten much better.
You were busy, and you're still busy, I'm sure.
It's not as bad as it was, because she's in daycare now. So that helps a lot. But you know what? We've teased the people enough about talking about the pandemic. Do you want to just slide into the episode and see how bad things are right now?
Let's do it.
Let's go. Almost half of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated against COVID-19, with about 70% being at least halfway vaccinated. And 70% is one of those magic numbers that was being thrown around a while back that... once we hit that, we'll be close to herd immunity. But among the unvaccinated, positive cases are soaring, and ICUs are overloaded yet again, and we have what really looks like a fourth wave of COVID just as we were finally turning a corner. This fourth wave is especially bad with the arrival of the Delta variant, a more easily transmissible version that current vaccines are 99% effective against, but breakthrough cases can and do occur, and the symptoms are much more severe. But just as the Delta variant evolved from the initial strain, we have to worry about what happens. We have to worry about what evolves from Delta. Will our current vaccines even work against another variant? And that's a concern for down the road. Right now, the states with the highest case numbers, Republican-heavy red states, are seeing an increase in vaccination rates, according to the White House. This would coincide with the recent turnaround from Republican leaders, who in the last couple of weeks have become very vocal about telling their constituents to get vaccinated. Most notably, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey called out, quote, the unvaccinated folks for the rise in COVID cases in her state. She said, folks are supposed to have common sense, but it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks. It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down. So both major parties seemingly are on board with getting people vaccinated, but will that be enough? Various cities and states are reimposing mask mandates, and the CDC has reversed its decision to abolish mask mandates for vaccinated persons. And then that makes me think that more lockdowns can't be too far off either. We'll talk about potential solutions to this. But first, Corey, Republican leaders seem to have changed their tune on this. What do you think brought them around, and do you think it's going to be effective in getting people vaccinated?
If I could be cynical here for a minute, probably the only thing that brought some of them around was having a family member get it and go to the hospital or get sick.
That would do it, yeah. I think it is different when it kind of, it happened to me, so now it's real. And you see stories floating around about people who refuse to get vaccinations and they themselves end up dying. And I don't like those stories because the tone seems to be spiking the football a little bit on a really tragic situation. But yeah, that would do it. So do you think it's going to work? Do you think people are actually going to get vaccinated now?
I know that some people who were hesitant or refused to get it before are now getting it, but in my experience, from people I've talked to, it's mostly because their employer is putting so much pressure on them that, you know, they don't want to lose their job. And they talk to some other people who feel the same way that they do. And some of them are saying, just get the stupid shot, whatever. Even if it doesn't work, it's just a shot.
Yeah, and it's weird to say, even if it doesn't work, but maybe within those communities, that's kind of what you have to say is like, just do it to save your employment. And employers are doing that. The federal government is now doing some light mandates. I saw Walmart is now doing mandates. The vaccine mandate is the one thing that's the one thing that we have.
Yeah, I heard recently that the federal government is going to put more pressure on its employees to get vaccinated.
Yes, they are, and it's I think it's that or weekly or monthly testing is the choice that that they have. And I don't know if you've had a COVID test. I've had some, and it's not pleasant. Like, I would rather get the shot.
I've had one, and yeah, the shot was better.
I think the vaccine mandate is good. Other countries are doing this too. France and Italy, and I think Israel, are all imposing vaccines for access to various things, including going to movies, concerts, getting into government buildings. And it won't get everyone, but I think it might be enough to get us over the hump. Because I feel like there's certain holdouts here that are not even anti-vax. They're just kind of doing it out of spite. But once it starts to make things inconvenient, like if they can't get into a football game come the fall, that might change their tune. Do you think that's enough, or do you think we're still going to be dealing with 20% of the population that refuses?
I think it would be a tremendous help, and I think they should have started doing it months ago. Yeah. Like, I don't understand why we don't have, if not vaccine passports, then at least that card that you get when you get the shot. You know, I just keep mine in my wallet, anticipating I might have had to use it, but I never have.
I remember being told, don't carry it around with you, to treat it like a passport where you only carry it when you have to. But I've kept it in my wallet ever since, just to be safe. And also because I'm kind of lazy about taking things out of my wallet.
Me too.
This was the way we should have done it. I understand if they didn't want to do this in March, when these were relatively new and not many people were getting them. But it's August. We've had in the country millions of people vaccinated across the world. I think it's getting close to 2 billion. We know this is effective, and we know that there are no, I don't say side effects, because my wife had a pretty nasty fever the day after she got hers. My arm hurt like hell, but we know that they're effective. We know that it's working. And yet there's been this resistance, and yet the vaccine mandate to me seems like the one thing that you can do to make this happen.
Yeah, I agree. And the only other thing I would say is, if you make something more inconvenient than getting the shot, then people will start go getting the shot.
Yeah. We're not likely to hit 100%, I don't think, but we also don't need to. It's just been really frustrating, and especially now that we talk about, we still haven't gotten kids under 12 to get it yet, and that's what I'm really itching for, is for my 3-year-old to finally be able to get it. Maybe we would be there by now if some people would just get the thing. Like, I understand some cases. I was talking to someone who has just this really nasty fear of needles. And she ended up getting the shot, but it took her longer than it would have because she's just so afraid of it. And I kind of get that, but
yeah.
We've all had to sacrifice quite a bit so far.
I think those mandates are coming back. I mean, not the mandates, I'm sorry, the lockdowns, because I've seen some cities are tightening up again. I know Los Angeles has a new mask mandate recently in the past week.
Yeah, the mask mandates are definitely coming back. The lockdowns, I'm not sure if that's going to happen again, just because there will be such resistance to it, not only from the original people who opposed the lockdowns to begin with, but also the people who, you know, like you and me, who've been following the rules. Now we have to get totally locked down again. Would be infuriating, just because of this relatively small segment of the public that doesn't want to do this, that we have to go into lockdown again. It would be so that's what, kind of why I feel like that's not gonna happen. They'll just do the mask mandate, which is the least effective way to do this. The middle one is going back to lockdowns, which would be unpopular, like I said, and then at the top is the vaccine mandate. I don't see any other way to get through this at this point, especially to get ahead of whatever next variant is coming.
Yeah, lockdowns would be really onerous again, but if we go back to that route, I mean, now we have different leadership in the country, and if people start dying thousands a day again, they might be a little more compliant. But maybe that's optimistic.
Yeah. I heard this take. If COVID had had a higher fatality rate, we probably would have had a lower number of deaths in total. If it had been a more serious virus, people would have taken it more seriously. But COVID was in that sweet zone of, it's a relatively low mortality rate. And so people didn't think it was that bad. And a lot of people could get COVID and not have any symptoms. What symptoms were pretty minor, so people didn't take it as seriously. Whereas like with Ebola or something, people take that seriously because it's really, really bad.
It makes sense.
It's a dark thought, but it's one of those things that occurred to me. Like, COVID was perfectly primed to really screw with our entire civilization. So how has your pandemic been going? And it's been a while since we've talked.
You know, it was pretty rough at first, but then after 3 or 4 months, I kind of got used to working at home all the time. And in fact, I'm still here.
Is there any sign you're going to work on site again?
Yeah, actually, I have to be back in the office on August 12th for a couple of, we're interviewing someone to fill our executive position. So,
okay, so some hiring. Yeah, that's always positive.
Yeah. So I think we're going to do a hybrid model. So probably by October 1st, we'll all be in at least 1 or 2 days a week, but not necessarily all 5 days.
Yeah, starting actually this coming week in August, I'll be on site 2 days a week, and we'll do that for a few months and see how it goes. And that's what I hope for. I'm hoping one change I really want us to keep, in addition to things like stimulus and child tax credits and everything else, I would really like us to do more like hybrid work, because I don't think I want to be, I'm not one of those people who wants to be at home every day, but a few days a week is really nice.
Yeah, I've come around to that. I used to be one of those people who hated working at home, and now I've gotten so used to it, and my dog has gotten so used to it that I kind of don't want to go back.
Sylvie and I have had that discussion where I think he was always working from home, and it was just him and the dog at home all day. And now yep. It's now he's actually in the office more often, if I remember correctly. And so as we close out the segment, do you have any concluding thoughts about vaccine mandates?
No, I would just encourage anyone who's not vaccinated to get vaccinated, please.
It's the least you can do, and it's free, and you can find it somewhere around your place. I'll say for my part, you can't really describe COVID as ever having gone away. But it does feel like it's back, right? It feels like that, and that's the most frustrating part. I was actually at a brewery last month. I sat down at a brewery for the first time in over a year, and now it's probably going to be a while before I get to do that again because I don't feel comfortable now. And on some level, like, the Delta variant was always going to hit us, but it didn't need to be this bad. It could have been easier than this, and we just wouldn't allow it to be, and that really sucks.
Yep.
All right, are you ready to move on?
Yep.
This episode is sponsored by...
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/AOS21. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Bill Cosby was released from prison last month after being convicted in 2018 on 3 counts of aggravated assault against former Temple University employee Andrea Constance, according to Variety and Reuters and a bunch of other sources. Most people seem to believe that he is guilty of his heinous crimes against women, including more than 50 victims even. But Americans, and especially Hollywood, also have short memories. Was it a miscarriage of justice that he was released so soon after just 3 years, or that, as former co-star Felicia Rashad declared to much backlash, that he stood trial in the first place? Is the Me Too movement faltering, or is Cosby such a sympathetic icon, America's dad, that the country has already forgiven his sins? Is celebrity more important than justice in our country?
Well, to that last one, yes. But I wonder if it's not so much celebrity as it is with having to do with the money that he has. I mean, celebrity plays some role. Like, the amount of the attention that this case got, for example, is because of his celebrity. Non-celebrity doesn't get... This trial is not as big a deal. He also gets, as a celebrity, a lot of emotional support from prominent people. You mentioned Felicia Rashad in a way that, again, you and I wouldn't have gotten if we were on trial for something.
His celebrity was also the reason that he got out on a technicality anyway, because he had an agreement with the prior Pennsylvania state's attorney to not prosecute him.
That's right. And that is kind of a miscarriage of justice, but I think, again, has more to do with the money that he has. Like, again, if that happens to you or I, where a previous district attorney tells us, okay, we're not going to prosecute you for this if you just play along here, and then his successor reneges on that and prosecutes us, Bill Cosby has the money to pay lawyers to take that all the way to the state Supreme Court. You and I don't have that. Most people don't have that. We can't pay those really good lawyers to find the holes in the original case, which there definitely were. This was very shady.
Yeah.
I think it's the celebrity, but it's also more just about the money. Like, he can do this. So in regard to the question about miscarriage of justice, Cosby would not have served any time had the AG not been, or the DA not been shady about this. So that's also not justice. And I kind of wonder if, in regard to the Me Too movement, if the DA in the case knew that this Fifth Amendment violation, which is what the Supreme Court cited as overturn his conviction, he knew that conviction would get overturned eventually, but that by prosecuting, he could get Cosby to serve at least a portion of a prison sentence that otherwise he was never going to get. So in that sense, there's a sense of fairness that he's actually paying in some way for his crimes. And then he could also say, hey, I'm the guy who did the thing that everyone clamored for, because as you point out with the Me Too movement, this happened at the height of this thing. He was convicted in April 2018, and the Me Too movement really takes off 2017 with the accusations against Harvey Weinstein. So, I don't know, ends justify the means. It's kind of a dark thing to consider.
Well, I want to say something a little brighter. I do not think the Me Too movement is faltering. In fact, we've seen a lot of cases where people who commit these kind of crimes actually do serve time. And even if they don't serve a lot of time, they're never going to work at their former jobs again. They've been basically blackballed from the industry. So
that's a very good point about this. So, sorry, it just said, I don't. Cosby will never be beloved again. He's never going to work again. I mean, his age, he doesn't need to, and probably wouldn't anyway. He's 80 something.
83. But, yeah.
83. Yeah. So he's, and no one's going to want to work with him. Yeah, there's kind of several miscarriages of justice here. Like, none of this is fair. I think one real miscarriage of justice here is that there's a statute of limitations on sexual assault. Only one of the 60 women claiming they've been assaulted, Andrea Constrand, still fell within that statute. So this was the only one that could get any traction. This was the only case on which Cosby was going to have to serve any kind of penalty or punishment. And again, that in general, with statutes of limitations, if you don't report a crime within X number of years, it's like, okay, well, how much did you care? Is it that important? But some crimes don't work that way. And we know that victims of rape and sexual assault can take a very long time to come forward if they come forward at all. And so do we need a statute of limitations on this crime? I don't think we do.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because, you know, your mental wounds from such a trauma don't have a statute of limitations. They're with you forever until you die, probably. I can only imagine. So it doesn't seem fair that if somebody, you know, some bureaucrat in the state or a lawyer failed to uncover enough evidence for a trial, that you should not be able to have justice for what happened to you.
It's shady what the second DA did, but I get it. Like, this was the only chance he's going to get. He ended up serving 3 years, right?
Yep, 3 years.
That's three more years than he would have served had anything else been done. So, you know, is that justice, really, in a sense?
Sort of. It may not be legal justice, but it's some kind of moral justice, perhaps.
Yeah. There are two concepts. There's legally correct, and then there's fair. Sometimes those are the same thing, and sometimes they're not. It's not fair that he got shafted the way he did by the DA, but it's also unfair that this is the most justice he'll ever face for this. And not just for what he did to Constrain, which it's only serving part of the sentence, but for, you know, 50 plus other women who aren't going to get any kind of recitation. Like,
exactly.
Do you have any closing thoughts on this segment?
No, I actually expected it might turn into a bigger story, but it's kind of just faded backwards into forgetfulness.
I think because people are so, because it's just, there's nothing to be done about it. I think that's the reason
it
really falls away. It's people are sad and upset, but also there's literally nothing that can be done. Because,
right.
Again, legally, I think the state Supreme Court was correct. Yeah, I'm going to link to an op-ed from the LA Times that states that even those who commit despicable crimes, which Cosby did and admitted to in the civil trial, even they are protected by the Constitution. That's something we kind of have to remember here. I don't think that DA is going to face any kind of consequences for what he did. I don't think he should necessarily have to. That's a different discussion for a different time. But yeah, this is just one of those. I understand why this story faded in the background. This was huge for like 6 hours or something, and then people just wanted to forget it. This was a hard one to swallow. All right, you ready to move on?
Let's do it.
This episode is sponsored by...
So I'm looking for some Expos merch, but all I'm seeing are old Andre Dawson jerseys. Do you know where I can find some more recent stuff?
Well, I don't know who, what, or where the expos are, but I can tell you that you can now pick up Washington Nationals gear from our friends over at Fanatics. Just head over to AOS21.com/theworldsonlypodcast and click on the banner at the top of our page to get great deals on World Championship Washington Nationals merchandise today.
Hey, wow, Fanatics actually has expo stuff. This is a great site.
So you've probably seen stories about restaurant workers, everyone from front-of-the-house servers to back-of-the-house kitchen crew, quitting their jobs. Occasionally, some restaurants are totally unstaffed and put signs on the door saying, you know, we all quit. Maybe you've experienced it yourself with staff quitting in the middle of their shifts, or maybe you are a person who quit your restaurant job in the middle of the shift, in which case I want to talk to you. I want to know that story. That 5.6% of restaurant employees nationwide quit just during the month of April. As of May, employment at eating and drinking establishments was 1.5 million jobs below pre-pandemic levels, or down about 12%, according to the National Restaurant Association. That timing in May coincides with a rise in customers going out to eat as people got vaccinated and mask mandates started dropping. Imagine your own workplace being short-staffed by 12% as demand goes up. You'd expect more hiring, right? But that's not easy. Low pay, long hours, difficult work environments, and that was before the pandemic hit. And a bunch of laid-off restaurant employees found other options and decided they aren't going back. And with the pandemic still raging, restaurants aren't any more appealing places to work. Now, Corey, you and I both have family that work in the restaurant and hospitality industries, so we're both coming at this from a personal standpoint, even if we're not directly involved. Is there any special insight you've gotten from them about how this has all been going over the last year or so?
Yeah, I have a brother who has worked in the kitchen and as a server for the past 6 or 7 years in Honolulu. So I reached out to him and asked him a few questions, and it was pretty sobering answers, honestly. And I kind of wish that he will never go back to the industry, but I think he's going to, for a very specific reason that maybe we'll get into later.
Okay. So he's not doing it now, but he was for a long time, and he's taken a break from that?
Well, he got laid off in March 2020, along with the entire restaurant staff, but he works at a Michelin-starred restaurant in a luxury hotel in Honolulu.
Oh, wow.
And they, very unusually, have been paying full health insurance for everyone who worked at the restaurant this whole time.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. So, you know, understandably, he sort of feels obligated to go back at least for a little while when they open October 1st.
So that's a little bit of an unusual situation because a lot of restaurant employees aren't getting that. I get your brother's perspective on that, that I would feel obligated to stay on, you know. And it sounds like they treat their people really well or as well as they possibly can. So it makes you more likely to do that. But a lot of restaurant workers don't really get that. It's pretty not great pay for long hours. The median pay for chefs and head cooks across the country was, as a couple of years ago, $26 an hour or about $53,000 a year. Now, that's a pretty solid salary, but that's the top guy at the restaurant in most cases outside of the owner. And that's usually also demanding 50 plus hour weeks. You're working nights, weekends, holidays. Burnout is a very real thing in this industry. Not to mention when you're in kitchens, long hours of dealing with customers, which is a whole other thing. Another thing with your brother in Honolulu, that's a place with a very high cost of living. Has he been doing anything else to fill his time since he's been laid off?
Yeah, he has. He had a friend who owned a liquor store, so he's been clerking at the liquor store, okay, you know, behind the register for about a year, I think. And before that, he had some months of unemployment. The interesting thing is that even though he's only making like minimum wage now, whereas before, being a server in a really top-tier expensive restaurant, he was making actually a lot of money.
Yeah, Michelin star restaurant, I would imagine.
Yeah, so he was able to buy a condo after only being there, you know, like 6 months. And he had worked in other top-tier restaurants before. This was just like the top of the mountain. But yeah, he was actually able, with his tips, not his wages, with his tips, to buy a condo in Honolulu, which, you know how expensive DC is. You know, you could probably double or triple that to buy something in Honolulu.
Yeah, Hawaii as a whole is crazy expensive. Yeah, that's really amazing. So he's probably in a relatively rare tier, you know, being able to do that there. So this is really, so I kind of understand all the more why he would want to stay in there. It's probably something he's not only dedicated a lot of time to, which restaurant workers is usually the norm, but it's something that has done really well for him. He's just sort of waiting this out. So I get in that case why he would want to stay. I would too.
Financially, yeah.
Financially, yeah, but also it seems like he likes it well enough, which is the case, especially if you're one of the top guys there, you know, you're more likely to do it. You know, my family, mostly at hotels and restaurants in Baltimore, and, you know, those are people that they go to culinary school to do it. And those kind of people really want that. They want to go into, that's what they want to go into. And it's a really hard job of, you know, 60-hour weeks. Like I said, you're working nights and weekends and holidays. It's really hard, but they chose to do it. But a lot of kitchen staff and front of house staff, it's a job they just kind of fell into because it looked like a good job, but then they're working 50, 60 hours a week, which leaves you very little time and energy to find anything else. And then what are you going to do? And so when the pandemic hit for the first time, a lot of them with, you know, unemployment were able to sort of figure out, okay, what am I going to do with my life? And from what I've been told, a lot of them end up going back to school, finishing degrees. They find other jobs. Now that things are a little safer, they're opening food trucks, so they're their own bosses now. They can keep their own hours. And so a lot of those jobs are just not going filled anymore because a lot of people finally got an opportunity to just leave.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one more thing I want to bring up that's really important here. And it's a lot of restaurant workers, especially those in the front of the house, they have a severe mental toll. It takes it out of you, not just physically, but mentally, because as my brother was saying, he doesn't have the right to stand up for himself or to do anything in the face of unreasonable requests and poorly behaving people. Whereas in a lot of jobs, you don't have to put up with that stuff, you know? So I think the mental health aspect, at least for some people, would be a major barrier to returning to that kind of a job.
Definitely. Anytime you're dealing with customers, and it's so frustrating, like, 'cause in front of house staff especially, but the back of the house gets it too. If their customers complain about the food, like they hear about it, have to deal with it, and it's awful to deal with. And management typically sides with the customer in a lot of those, just because it's easier. For a lot of people, they finally got a chance to escape it and realized, oh, I'm happier not doing that. And so you have to fill those holes now. And so the question here is, what's the future for restaurants? I kind of thought, like, I don't think robots are the answer to this, because you see all the time about fast food employees getting replaced by touch screens, and that work. And I don't think that works for, like, certainly doesn't work for a Michelin star restaurant, right? It's not even going to work for like a mid tier restaurant. Right. And then robots being able to cook on its own episode of Futurama. Like, I don't think this is one of those industries that gets automated the same way some other industries can. One thing that's happening is higher pay. Some restaurants are offering better wages, often still below minimum wage. So I'm not sure if that's enough. And for a lot of ex-restaurant workers, I don't see even higher pay bring them back, because more money can delay burnout, but it won't eliminate it.
And I think for a lot of customers, I'm not really one of them, but I think a lot of them go to restaurants for those interactions with their servers. You know, they want to meet new people and have a good time and talk.
Yeah. Well, having a role, it feels like some sort of gimmick you'd see in something. I just don't want it.
And how's your family members been faring?
So they're doing okay. Like, nobody lost their job, but good. My brother-in-law's head chef at a restaurant near Baltimore's Inner Harbor, and he just got that job like a few months into the pandemic. They were planning to give him this restaurant attached to a hotel. And then the pandemic hit, and then they sort of delayed it. And then last fall or something, they said, okay, we're just going to do it. And it's still open, but it was really hard for a while. They were pulling down, I probably shouldn't give you their numbers exactly, but they weren't doing well night to night, but it's still open. They're still pulling through, and it looks like it's going to come through this thing.
Is it the kind of restaurant that was able to pivot to delivery or takeout, or not so much?
Not delivery, but they did do takeout. People take advantage of that. And because they're attached to a hotel, they were mostly just doing room service orders for a long time.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So it's, and unusually for kitchens, because it's so busy, it's such a demanding job. There's a lot of time spent cleaning in the kitchen, just a lot, because that's the only thing you could do for an hour at a time, because you didn't have any orders coming in, which is a very scary place to be if you're working in a restaurant. You're not used to that.
Yeah, that's odd.
Just to close this out, one of the things I miss most about during the pandemic is going out to eat. And I've done a little bit of that since, including at, you know, my brother-in-law's restaurant. And this is not to say that people should stop doing that, that people should stop going out to eat. That's not what current or former restaurant workers would want you to do. But I am going to appreciate it more in the future when I go out to eat for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, I was just out earlier this week at a restaurant, and I was surprised how busy it was, actually. But yeah, I don't actually miss it as much as I thought I would. But in line with what you're saying, I am more appreciative of the people who work there, and I'm going to try to just relax a little more and enjoy myself next time.
This episode is sponsored by...
Hello, listeners. If you like the World's Only Podcast, then you'll love our merchandise, right, Ian?
I guarantee.
Head on over to tpublic.com/AOS21, that's AOIS21, for all the latest and greatest in World's Only merchandise. Also check out the merchandise of other AOS21 podcasts as well.
I guarantee.
Gun violence has been a resurgent issue in some major American cities recently, including D.C. and Baltimore, where it's actually been a problem for the past several years. Even here in Alexandria, where I live, reports of shots fired have risen drastically over the past year, although most incidents do not result in fatalities, fortunately. The rash of shootings does not seem to be primarily gang-related, and they often occur, at least in my city, in rich and tourist-friendly neighborhoods. With the gun trafficking task forces and other initiatives recently announced by Attorney General Merrick Garland, will they make any difference? Are deadly shootings and gun violence part of our American DNA, or is there a feasible way out of this mess?
I admit that I'm pessimistic on this. I don't know how you realistically handle this. I mean, we just have too many guns. Part of the reason I backed off of my gun control stance to a large degree is that there are just so many guns here. The NRA spent years making guns okay to have and having more guns produced and sold, and now there are too many to realistically do much about it. Maybe that's just to save myself some sanity on it. I don't see how you do it, but I think what... the Justice Department, the Biden administration doing are pretty smart in terms of the supposed crime wave that's going on. I think there's a lot of concerns about rising crime going right now. There's a big narrative about crime being on the rise. The long-term trends on violent crime are still way, way down. But every now and again, Americans get really scared by the idea of crime, especially when a Democrat is in the White House. So what they've done, I think, here is pretty smart about saying, okay, we're going to target weapons trafficking. We're going to, you know, there's been a, if you've ever heard of the idea of the iron pipeline, this is something I first heard about in the context of guns being shipped from Indiana, which has loose gun laws, into Chicago, where there are much stricter gun laws. But something you see all over the country with guns moving into states that try to keep them out, I-95 is a major pipeline for guns, moving guns from Florida and Georgia into places like D.C. and Baltimore. So in case you didn't hate I-95 enough, here's another reason. Nearly yeah. Two-thirds of guns associated with crime in Baltimore come from out of state. So I don't know how much you can fully stop the trafficking of it. You can probably stop it en masse. You're not going to fully stop it, but you can try to bring it down. I think that's a pretty smart way to try to do this.
I think it's a good effort, and they need to make that effort. But I should note that apparently they tried something similar many years ago in Chicago, according to Mayor Lori Lightfoot, and it didn't really make any tangible impact. So hopefully it'll work out a little better this time, but I am also pretty skeptical about it.
I mean, the difference here is it's a federal effort as opposed to a city or state effort, because the feds control interstate travel, and so you can stop that. Or they have better tools with which to stop it. I found out during research for this segment that gun trafficking is not considered a crime, which I kind of feel like maybe it should be. But typically, when you go after, you have plans like this, those that are prosecuted get prosecuted under things like conspiracy or prohibited possession or making false statements. That's a good way to go. But maybe gun trafficking, you know, becomes a federal crime. A federal crime, transporting weapons across state lines, is a crime now.
I think making it a crime would certainly help, at least in the long term. Probably won't have many tangible effects in the next year or two, but. Sorry, I guess the only other way to stop it would be to put checkpoints on major arteries like I-95, and it's already congested enough. I don't see that being remotely feasible.
I mean, I think it depends where you put those checkpoints, because you do see those things for drugs sometimes on, again, often less crowded highways. If you're doing it on, say, I-95, you wouldn't do it in the anywhere, certainly not in the Virginia suburbs where I-95 gets real, real bad. You might do it further south, somewhere between Richmond and North Carolina, maybe. I don't know exactly where you'd do it, but it's from a practical level, I think choke point maybe probably is a good idea. And it comes back to the idea that I think a lot of us, including myself, have kind of given up on the idea of any kind of real gun control or any kind of attempt to stop this. But that doesn't mean you don't try something.
Another avenue to try might be to go back to the courts. I know, it might be really hard to overturn the 2008 D.C. versus Heller case, in which gun control is effectively eliminated in the district. But
I don't see the courts overturning that one, at least as they're currently made up. And then the other thing is that we, with a lot of things, including like the war on crime, war on drugs, war on poverty, we attack the symptoms, not the causes. It's like I've been doing some reading about LA's recent moves toward making homelessness effectively illegal. And so governments will attack the poor, but they'll turn around and go after the consequences of poverty. So they'll fight gangs and drugs. But maybe if you actually helped people, you wouldn't have so many other problems to fight. So, sorry, it's a little off topic there, but guns get transported to the inner cities to, that have like gang violence. Well, maybe if you do something about the gangs, maybe you provide a better social safety net for people in those cities. Maybe if you do something, and again, those end up becoming much bigger problems. You talk about DC and Baltimore. Baltimore, especially with like the schools issue, it's a huge, huge problem.
Yeah.
But all it seems like all that we're suited to do is attack the symptoms rather than the causes.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think a lot more money should be funneled to education in depressed areas, and allowing people to actually get the education they need for better paying jobs, and then that sort of obviates the need to look for money in other ways, less legal ways. But again, that's a really long-term kind of thing, and I don't know if this is going to change even in the next 10 years.
Yeah. What surprised me a little bit is you talk about in Alexandria seeing some of this happen. Are you in Old Town or are you somewhere else?
I work in Old Town, and that's where a lot of stuff is going on, but I live in the West End, which is okay. Closer to Springfield in I-95.
So for listeners who are not from the D.C. area, Old Town, Alexandria, it's a nice area, lots of restaurants, shopping. You have the waterfront, you have beautiful old buildings, and it's getting more touristy now, which is what happens when a favorite local spot gets too much attention. But it's one of those things where hearing like shots fired in Old Town really surprises me. Whereas if it were that would happen when it does happen on the other side of the river in southeast DC, nothing gets done about it because it's happening here in Old Town, a nice area, the place where the white people live, it gets more attention. Again, it becomes about concern about rising crime. Do you have any indication for why this is happening in Old Town more often?
I suspect it's because our current mayor has been really aggressive in pushing business. We have, even in the 10 years I've worked in Old Town, there has been a drastic rise in luxury condos and other fancy buildings. And it's actually pushed out a lot of lower income Section 8 housing.
So
I have a feeling that they're kind of mad about that because those neighborhoods have been there for centuries. And now they're just sort of being wiped out. And told, you can't afford to live here anymore, get out. And it's not just happening in Old Town Alexandria, it's happening all over the place in this area and probably across the country too.
Yeah, it happens all over. People get pushed out and it becomes, so unfortunately what happens is Old Town will get some attention for this and the police will crack down on this, but it's not actually going to solve the real problem. They're going to protect the people in the high-end condos, and then everyone else. It's a bad situation. Like, because Old Town has the resources to do something about it, but they'll only do something about it that protects the of the most important people there.
Right, and in my section of the city, we don't have any. We have very few luxury condos. It's a very mixed neighborhood in terms of income and ethnicity and immigrants and natives. So. I see a police car maybe once a year when a water main breaks, and that's it. Whereas I go to Old Town to work, and I see 4 or 5 per day. It's a huge difference.
I guess it's just been so long since I've been down there, like partly pandemic, but it's so wild to think about that.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's heartbreaking. Also, like, you can completely see it happening. It's, I don't know. It's we obviously need some more serious gun control than what we have. I've given up a lot of hope that it can happen. But even the gun control issue, like, aligns to the fact that this is a symptom rather than a cause. We're not treating things like mental illness. We don't properly treat things like poverty. And so, yeah, you get more gun violence as a result. This is America.
I thought I might go into the originalist individualist versus collectivist part of the Second Amendment, but I think that's probably a whole discussion that deserves its own time. So,
yeah, I know what you mean—the well-regulated militia and the you know versus.
Yeah.
No, I just want to own all the guns I want. Well, that's. You're just being selfish.
This episode is sponsored by...
Hi, Worlds Only listeners. Ian here. Are you craving more Worlds Only content? I got some good news. If you become an AS21 patron, that's exactly what you'll get. See, we usually give you 4 new segments every episode, but we actually record 5 segments. That's right. That's 1 segment a month you're not getting for free, but you can if you join at patreon.com/AS21. By becoming a patron, you'll get our 5th segments, plus more podcast content from AS21, like Publish Me and Passion on the Page. So much great stuff. So if you're jonesing for more Worlds Only and AS21 content, go to patreon.com/AS21. Isn't that right, Silby?
That's right. You love our voices, so now love them even more.
The 2020 Olympics are underway in Tokyo. Yes, it's 2021. But if the IOC isn't going to change the signage that says Tokyo 2020, then there's no reason for us to change either. Now, it's perhaps obvious to point out that these Olympics are very different from other games in the past. The stadiums are empty and fewer athletes are attending. Some of those that are in attendance are dropping out as COVID cases continue to pop up and for other reasons as well. Despite a small outbreak at the athletes' hotel, the cases have been relatively limited among Olympic officials. But Tokyo as a whole, which is under its 4th state of emergency right now, reported almost 3,000 new cases in one day this past week, breaking a previous record set in January. So even under lockdown, cases in Japan, which has mostly done a very good job containing the pandemic, are spiking. And this hasn't been helped by Japan's low vaccination rate. As of this week, just 25% of Japanese citizens are fully vaccinated. Citizens of Olympic host cities are rarely happy about hosting the Olympics. But this is especially true in Tokyo right now, where, according to some polls, upwards of 80% of the population of Japan do not want the Olympics to be held in Tokyo. And despite stay-at-home orders, protests are persisting in Tokyo, raising further concerns about the spread of COVID. Corey, are you feeling the Olympic spirit?
Not really. And I don't blame the residents of Tokyo at all for wanting the games for the reasons you specified. And, you know, they can't go either. So what's good for them?
Yeah, and its impact on Japan is going to be so much more immense than usual. Like, it's always pretty bad. But
yeah.
I mean, the Olympics rarely return on their investment, but these games definitely will not be able to do it. The lack of people and attendance means that financially, this is a loser from the start. You're not going to make that money back. And it's wild to me. I guess I didn't really realize this. When a city is awarded the Olympic Games, they cede all control to the IOC, to the International Olympic Committee. They don't have the right to cancel them. They don't have the right to postpone them. The IOC agreed to postpone them last year, but they're making Tokyo go ahead with it. Like, Japan, Tokyo have no say in this whatsoever. And so the government's trying to get through as best they can. There's a quote I'll share from one Japanese public health expert that said the government has sent signals that people are supposed to stay home at the same time they're supposed to celebrate the games. It's a totally inconsistent message. And that's correct. Japanese health officials have been saying for months that these games can't go on, but here we are because we have no choice. And, you know, there's money that needs to be garnered from this, or we need to get some of our investment back.
And the Olympics are a sign of returning to normalcy also.
Yeah, and that's what they're supposed to be. That's clearly not what they're are you watching any of the Olympics right now?
A little bit. I watched the U.S. women's soccer team defeat the Netherlands yesterday morning. I watched win a gold medal last night. But to be honest, Ian, the best part of the Olympics for me so far has been watching the highlight show with Kevin Hart and Snoop Dogg.
How is that? I haven't watched it.
It's really funny.
Is it? Okay. Maybe I'll have to give that a shot. But it doesn't feel the same, right? Because you don't have the fans in the stands. And so when someone does something really impressive, there's just no reaction at all. It's very quiet, very sterile. It's more boring to watch than usual.
Yes. I think Euro 2020, which also kept the 2020 moniker, even though it was played
yep,
in June.
Yep, it did.
I think it worked a lot better because maybe, you know, it was just a single sport. The game didn't really change with no fans in the stands, at least for those of us watching on TV. And I think they controlled COVID pretty well.
There were fans in the stands at Euro 2020, but I think having just a few stadiums, you can control that
a little
better. You also have the European countries are doing better with vaccination than Japan is right now. And also they're less strict about the lockdowns than Japan has been.
Yep.
So that's part of it. I said on our year-end review in 2020 that I was really looking forward to these Olympic Games. There's an ongoing discussion between Sylvie and I about whether the Olympics are a good thing. And on the whole, I kind of think they're not. But while I'm watching them, I forget about all the bad stuff. Like, I enjoy watching sports that I don't normally get to see on TV. Like, I've been watching a little bit of the skateboarding. Some of the track and field events are really fun. But that's the danger of the whole enterprise. Like, how many people outside of Brazil remember the scouring of the favelas before and during the Rio 2016 games? Like, this leaves bad scars on the cities that host them.
People like you and me remember that because we read about it and we think about it. But, you know, there's not a lot of people who actually do that.
Yeah. But, and the people in Rio certainly remember.
It
upends their whole lives, at least for a little bit of time. I've proposed before, like, that maybe there should be like a permanent Olympic host that can, maybe they would be better prepared to do this so that cities don't get upended just for a few months and then have buildings they'll never use again. If you have a permanent host, like Athens seems like the obvious one to host the summer games. Okay, they can come up with ways to contain things. When they build a new building, it's like maybe they'll build like one or two new buildings a year and that becomes something you can use for other events during non-Olympic years. It's less destructive, but that's not the way it works. The IOC just is a vampire. just sucking every life force out of the cities that host these things. And it's just never a good investment.
Yeah. I think whatever city might be a permanent host would need a lot of financial support to be able to do that. Like constant support.
Having it be more predictable would help. Having your infrastructure and your economy and your people know that, hey, every 4 years we're doing this thing would be more stabilizing.
They might, yeah, they would probably adapt. You're right.
Yeah, it would be easier. Like Tokyo, like it happens every year. What was it? I forget which Spanish city hosted, and they end up building an airport for their Olympics, and that airport is never used now. It's basically abandoned.
Is that the Barcelona game?
It might be Barcelona. It's just such a waste.
It is, but I think there's such amount of prestige that comes with hosting the Olympics. Maybe if we could diminish that a little bit, there wouldn't be some competition to have the games in the city.
I mean, I wonder about the prestige. It's certainly prestigious for a few people, like people in the IOC. I think politicians in the cities really think it's worth their while.
Well, there's your problem right there.
Yeah, it's it's these few powerful people who are going to make out very well from this, and everyone else pays the price for it. And it's hitting Japan especially hard right now, and I just feel for them so bad. Because this was, prior to the pandemic, this was going to be like, oh, this is Japan showing that we're still on the world stage here after a couple of rough-ish decades with the economy. That's a dicey situation. And then, okay, now the pandemic hits. Okay, 2021 will show the world that we're back, ready to go. No, we're not. We shouldn't be doing this. And they didn't have any say in it.
I'm surprised they have such a low vaccination rate.
I was too. So I did some research here. I'll post analysis talking about how, for one thing, the Japanese government requested more data about the efficacy of the vaccines, both in domestic trials in Japan and also to see what happened internationally. So that put them behind. They didn't start vaccinating until sometime in February.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And there's also a cultural issue where many Japanese are wary of vaccines that are made abroad, hence why they wanted more data. And so a Japanese company is now working on their own vaccine, which is expected by the end of the year. They have enough doses, but there's also now uncertainty as to if they have enough medical staff to provide them, because Japanese medical professionals are also leaving the profession, just like you see all over the world, because they're so burned out. So, yeah, it surprised me, too, that Japan was so far behind. I'll post analysis. It kind of makes sense. We should start wrapping up here. Do you have any closing thoughts?
just my only thing with the Olympics is they don't show enough live events with different sports on TV. You have to go hunting for it or get an app. And I wish they would be a little more equitable to people other than the really big names in the big money sports.
The really big American names in the big money sports. Yeah, that's
yeah.
Frustrating. So I haven't done this myself. I've been told if you have a VPN and you watch, I think it's the Canadian Broadcasting Company, they do really well at just showing the events, at just showing the events straight through without any like video packages or anything else.
Right.
It's really good. I haven't done that myself yet, but
I know in the Rio games, I think if you downloaded like the mobile app, you could actually watch live broadcasts without any sort of fluff around it. And it didn't matter if it was the United States or not, you could just watch. And that's what I wish we would have on regular TV.
I wish NBC does a terrible job. It's and a lot of like recap, a lot of the recap and highlights. I don't want to watch that. I want to watch the event.
Exactly.
Anyway, just 6 months until the Winter Olympics.
Crazy.
Beijing 2022. Oh, that'll go very well.
Oh, okay.
Sure. Well, that will do it for this month. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again next month. Please recommend us to friends, family, leave a rating, subscribe, whatever you can do to get the word out. We appreciate it so much. Corey, thank you for filling in.
Well, thanks for having me back. I always enjoy doing these.
Yeah. Where can people find you on social media?
I've been taking kind of a social media hiatus this year.
That's very smart. Very smart.
They eventually can find me at Beer Nerdtastic on Twitter.
All right. And you can find me at iRobertsLibrarian. Sylvie is at Sylvie_says. Thank you again for listening to us. We will talk to you again in 1 month's time. Stay safe, everybody. This pandemic is not over, and we want you all to make it through to listen to more nonsense from this show. So say bye-bye to the people, Corey.
Goodbye. And I hope you enjoy Anthony Rizzo and Pinstripes as much as I do.
I hate you so much. That is still raw. I thought because Sylvie wasn't here, I wasn't going to have to deal with that. Oh, I'm crying.
I grew up a Yankee fan, too.
Oh, God. All right.
Sorry.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the World's Only Podcast, a production of the AOS 21 Podcast Network, hosted by Podomatic and available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play. Find us online at media.aos21.com. We'll see you all next month as the world keeps turning.
Copyright 2021, AS21 Media. The AS21 Podcast Network. Your voice, your story, your passion, our mission.